From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Carl Castle, and here's your host at the Chase Bank Auditorium in downtown Chicago, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Carl. Thank you, everybody. Thank you so much. Maybe you asked Santa for a toy train, or maybe the hot new toy, TSA Scan Me Elmo. Or maybe you asked Santa for some
not
of the...
Not there! Please not there!
Or maybe you asked Santa for some of the best Not My Job games from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, all collected in one easy-to-listen-to show.
On the unlikely chance that's the case, we offer up this special holiday best of Not My Job.
Let's start with our interview with Dick Van Dyke, a man whose TV show and films are so beloved by so many and watched over and over again by succeeding generations that they named the DVD after him.
The star of Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, Mary Poppins, and The Dick Van Dyke Show joined panelists Peter Gross, Kiri O'Connor, and Mo Rocca back in October. And Peter Sagal started by, well, dorking out a bit.
All right, I just got to be personal. I have watched you for so long. Chitty Chitty Bang Bang was my favorite movie when I was a kid, and I've watched Mary Poppins so many times, The Dick Van Dyke Show. So my first question to you is, will you be my dad?
I'm a little busy right now.
I understand.
I can be your grandpa.
That would be fine. I would take that at this point. Out of all the things you've done, is there one thing you're most proud of?
Well, I tell you, I gauge it by the amount of fun I had. And we all of us involved say the Dick Van Dyke Show was the best 5 years of our lives. It was, we were like otters at play.
Right.
It would never was worse.
Really? That's great. One of the odd things about that show, I mean, in a weird way, it was 30 Rock, I guess 40 years before 30 Rock, in the sense that it was a comedy TV show about a comedy TV show.
Exactly right.
I thought that up myself. So, so I guess my question is, you made working in TV comedy look like an absolute joy. You and Maury Amsterdam and Rose Marie having a great time going home to your great house in New Rochelle. Was it really like that working on the show?
It was. Everybody looked forward to coming to work every day. It was, Carl, of course, was a brilliant, brilliant writer.
Carl Reiner.
And we just couldn't wait to get in front of the audience and show them what we had. It was... I never wanted to quit. Carl wanted to quit after 5 years. He thought perhaps it got repetitive or something. I'd still be doing it if he'd let me.
How did you get started? You grew up in Danville, Illinois.
Right.
And you we're here in Illinois, and people are excited about that. And you started at a young age, right? You were singing, you were doing comedy. What were you doing?
Well, at the time, believe it or not, I started out as a teenager in radio.
Really?
I was an announcer at 16. During the war, everybody got drafted, so they had to hire me. Huh. And that got me started.
Doing radio?
Yeah.
So there's a future in this.
Yes, there is.
I had no idea. And you went out to the coast, as they say? You went out to L.A.?
Yeah, I went out here with a buddy of mine, and we did a little nightclub act. And oh, I did local television in Atlanta and New Orleans, little shows, and finally ended up under contract to CBS. And I did game shows, children's shows. Do you know that I was the anchor on the CBS morning show?
No.
And my newsman was Walter Cronkite.
Really?
I'm not kidding.
Oh, my gosh.
Really? Could you please come back?
You had this gift that we saw particularly, in the famous tripping over the ottoman and your great dance numbers in Mary Poppins for physical comedy. Is that something you figured out you had at a young age?
Yes, I used to copy Laurel and Hardy and Buster Keaton.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I mastered all those falls when I was a kid.
Oh, really? I mean,
yeah.
This is what you did? You mean other kids were outside playing baseball and you were tripping over ottomans? Is there any chance that you're going to start singing again?
I have a little quartet, three guys and me. We started out just singing at my house, having a pizza and singing every Tuesday night.
Yeah.
Somebody asked us to do a benefit, and then we did another one and another one. And all of a sudden, in August, we ended up at the Ford Theater in Washington singing for the president.
So you met the president?
Yeah.
When the president said, you know, I loved you in, what did he say? What was his thing?
Well, his wife, Michelle, said, you're my favorite show. And he said, she's not kidding.
There you are. You did Mary Poppins, and despite your amazing charm and the incredible success of the movie, you did get a little guff for your accent.
I'll never hear the end of that. But I have a defense.
What is your defense, sir?
They got me a coach who was Irish.
Oh.
His name was Pat O'Malley, and he didn't do an accent any better than I did.
Really? I heard once, is this true that the author of the Mary Poppins book, Mrs. Travers, showed up on the set?
Oh, I didn't see her on the set, but she did show up at the premiere.
Yes, and what did she think?
She went out in the lobby afterward and said, "Walt, all the animation has to go."
Oh.
Is that so? And Walt said, "Mary, the boat has sailed."
It's in the movie.
Yeah, she didn't care for either Julie or me.
Really?
Yeah, she wanted a kind of a, you know, a plump little nanny and an older kind of a cockney guy. But I think Walt was wise enough to go his own way.
I think he was. Dick Van Dyke, what a pleasure to have you on our show. We have asked you here this week to play a game we're calling...
Dick Van Dyke, Meet Dick Van and Dyke.
Dick Van Dyke. Together, an iconic name in entertainment, but separated into its component words, it's three different things we can ask you about. Get two questions about the parts of your own name right. You'll win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl's voice in the home answering machine. Carl, who is Dick Van Dyke playing for?
Dick is playing for Jeff Weinkoff of Eugene, Oregon.
Your first question, of course, is about a dick. In this case, Dick.
About what?
About a dick. A dick, okay. Dick. It's about Dick Nixon, specifically.
Yeah.
When a young man, Dick Nixon, fell in love with one Pat Ryan, who was acting in a play with her, he courted her fiercely, including doing what? A, composing a song in her honor titled Pat Pat, You Make My Heart Go Pitter-Pat, B, driving her to and from dates with other men, or C, making what some say might be history's first ever mixtape.
I think he wrote a song.
You think you're going to go with that?
Yeah.
Sadly, no, he did not write a song. He drove her to and from dates with other men and wait around, like in a bookstore or a movie theater, until she was done and drive her home.
You're trying to say he was a pimp?
I'm sorry, but in the universe in which I live, you, Dick Van Dyke, do not know that word. I'm having some trouble. All right, we've done Dick.
What?
We've done Dick. Now it's time for Van. Chrysler.
Okay.
Chrysler, they invented the minivan back in the 80s, has a brand new revolutionary van on the production line. What is it? A, the man van, the masculine minivan for men. B, the speed van, a 12-cylinder, 300-horsepower van that can do 180 miles per hour. Or C, the nano van, half the size of a standard minivan, but with still 7 seats.
Oh, my word. I think it was called a man van.
Man van, you're right. It is the man van.
Oh, wait.
Men are notoriously resistant to minivans, so this one is designed to be appeal to them, more masculine. It'll have a, quote, sportier look, more chrome in the interior, that sort of thing. All right. We've done Dick. We've done Van. Now it's time for your third question on the subject of dykes.
I was afraid of that.
Yes. So we Googled, just because we were curious, world's biggest dyke. What did we find? Was it A, the Sammangium Dyke in the Yellow Sea, the Zuiderzee Dyke in the Netherlands, or the Weir Dyke near Lincolnshire in England?
I think it's the Zuiderzee.
You think it's the Zuiderzee?
Yeah.
That's an old dyke.
Well, I'm Dutch. It's got to be Zuiderzee.
Is that the first one or the third one, the Zuiderzee?
The Zuiderzee is the second one I mentioned.
What country was the first one in?
It's in the Yellow Sea.
The Yellow Sea? Oh, that one in China?
Yes.
Oh, that is the biggest one.
You're right.
Yeah.
Wow. 21 miles long. Wait a minute.
I forgot about that one.
You actually knew that?
Yes, but it's fairly new, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah, I knew all about that.
He's got to know all about all the dykes in the world. If your last name was Dyke, you'd keep up on all of them.
Well, that's remarkable. Carl, how did Dick Van Dyke do in our quiz?
Dick Van Dyke had two correct answers, Peter. So, Dick, you win for Jeff Weinkoff.
Well done.
Do you know there are words to that?
Really?
What are the words to the Dick Van Dyke theme song?
You want me to sing it for you?
Yes.
So you think that you got trouble? Well, trouble's a bubble. So tell old Mr. Trouble to get lost. Why not hold your head up high and stop crying? Start trying. And don't forget to keep your fingers crossed. When you find the joy of living is loving and giving, you'll be there when the winning dice are tossed. A smile is just a frown that's turned upside down. So smile on that frown or defrost. And don't forget to keep your fingers crossed. Ba-doom, doom.
Oh! No, that was the greatest. That is fantastic. I love that.
Boy answered him, Roquette.
Did he really?
That
yeah.
is fantastic.
Wow.
I may never be happier than I am right now.
This is going to be, this is NPR's first iTunes hit.
This is amazing. Dick Van Dyke made some of the best movies and TV shows I have ever seen, and I keep watching them. What a joy to finally talk to you and have you on our show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you, sir.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Carl Castle, and here again is your host at the Chase Bank Auditorium in downtown Chicago, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Carl. Thank you, everybody. Thank you so much. We are listening back today to interviews with some of our favorite celebrity guests, a list which has to include actor Tony Shalhoub. He's a normal guy. He's become famous playing eccentric people. There was his obsessed Italian chef in Big Night, his alien pawn shop owner in the Men in Black movies, but mostly, of course, he's known as the obsessive compulsive detective Monk on the TV series of that name.
He joined us along with Luke Burbank, Kerry O'Connor, and Paula Poundstone earlier this year.
Check my characterization. I've seen a lot of your movies and TV shows over the years. I cannot think of when you once played a normal person. Is this true, or am I not being fair?
I think you're right. I don't remember normalcy in my career. Something overtakes me, and I kind of try to turn them into something not so normal. So it's partly my fault.
So the initial character is kind of Mike Brady's standard issue.
Exactly. That's what Adrian Monk was, actually, to
yes.
start with.
Really? And you showed up and started twitching.
I said, I think this guy twitches. And then they build a series around it.
But by being a success in a TV series, you always run the risk of being identified with that role. So do you have people coming up to you and going, oh, I'll shake your hand. No, I won't, because I know how you feel.
Yeah, I've heard that about 6,000 times.
I can imagine.
Today.
Today.
Yeah.
Does it get tired? Were you worried about that as you continued during the series, that you were being known for this one role?
It's always kind of a risk, an inherent risk when you're an actor, and you even if it's a movie role, sometimes people just get pegged as that one thing. But maybe when I was younger, typecasting might have been a problem. Now it's any kind of casting is good.
Basically, you take typecasting.
I'll take fly casting at this point.
It could have been a lot worse. People could have seen you and gone like, dynamite!
That's right.
Oh, yes.
That's right.
You could have a catchphrase.
Yeah, exactly.
You starred in Big Night, one of my favorite movies. For those who haven't seen it, it's about two brothers from Italy who try to open an Italian restaurant in New Jersey. And it doesn't go well, and it's about the last night of its operation where they serve the most amazing meal ever served on film.
Oh, Peter, I really don't think there's anybody who hasn't seen that.
That's true. Was that meal real? Did you get to eat it?
Well, yes. Well, a lot of the things were real. We did actually make them over, the course of the making of the film. Of course, while you're filming and doing multiple takes, food tends to... It tends to get a little undesirable.
It wouldn't stop me in the case of that meal.
No, but I've gotten a lot of free Italian meals in restaurants from people.
Really?
People who like that. I consider it my back end on the movie.
Really?
Kind of, yeah.
This endless free pasta special.
Exactly.
Which is weird because you are not, in fact, Italian.
I'm not. Yes, you're right. No, I'm actually Lebanese.
You're Lebanese from Green Bay, Wisconsin.
Which is kind of like being Italian. I don't know.
I know. It's like you probably had to stand in for. You played all the ethnic characters in the school plays, I'm sure, in Green Bay.
I actually played the black characters in the plays in Green Bay.
Dynamite.
You think I'm kidding?
No, I'm not. I've been to Green Bay. You were totally not kidding.
Yes.
We have one last question for you. When we have a guest on, of course, we sit down to do a lot of research to learn a lot of things about them, and instead we just play video games all day, and then right before the show go to Wikipedia. and your Wikipedia mentions a connection between you and somebody named Dan Shalhoub.
Well, Dan would be my brother.
Dan is your brother.
That's correct.
And according to Wikipedia, Dan Shalhoub, your brother, has a particular claim to fame.
Well, he is the inventor of the shapoopy.
The shapoopy.
Which is a thing that all dog owners who live in the urban areas should have. It's not just a pooper scooper. It's better than that. Mm-hmm. It actually catches the poop before it hits the ground.
Wow.
Whoa. Now, wait. We have to back up here because I have two dogs. Now, do you have to position this thing?
Oh, my God.
No, your dog does that. Yes, of course you have to position it.
You have to position it. So.
You know, it wasn't always going to be called the Shapoopy. There were many, many, there were many pitches for names for this
program. Oh, tell us them all.
The thing is, it has a telescoping handle, you see, so you can extend it. It's very small and compact to carry. So one of them, we were going to call it the long arm of the log.
Yeah.
Okay, that's enough.
I love this whole family.
Well, Tony Shalhoub, we were delighted to have you here. But we have asked you here to play a game we're calling...
Sure, you solved crimes, but did you ever fly? I think not.
Tony Shalhoub, you played a monk, so we're going to ask you about nuns.
Okay, that makes no sense.
That's how we do. Answer two questions about nuns. You'll win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl's voice for their home answering machine. Carl, who is actor Tony Shalhoub playing for?
Tony is playing for Nancy Martin of Venice, California.
Ready to do this?
Does Nancy have a dog?
First question, Tony. First question. Some nuns in Italy got in trouble with the law last year. What did they do? A, they got pulled over going 112 miles per hour in a Ford Fiesta in a hurry to go see the Pope. B, they made so much noise at a late night caffe klatch, the police were called by neighbors. Or C, they were busted for growing hallucinogenic mushrooms.
Okay, well, I went to a Catholic school, when I was a kid. And knowing the nuns, I'm going to have to go with C, hallucinogenics.
Wait a minute, knowing nuns as you do, you thought they were growing...
That's right.
That's the sort of thing the nuns might be doing?
Well, they're very spiritually oriented.
They certainly are. So your choice is hallucinogenic mushrooms. No, actually, it was speeding.
Oh, wow.
Quoting the nun behind the wheel, the police were shocked to find three nuns of a certain age in the Fiesta, but we were afraid of getting there late to see the Pope. She was fined more than $500 and lost her license.
Oh, my.
It's all right. She could still fly, though. She's a nun.
Oh, God.
Two more chances. In 2008, an Italian priest was criticized for trying to bring attention to nuns by doing what? A, holding a nun beauty pageant. B, convincing Italian paparazzi to follow around nuns because, quote, they're celebrities in the eyes of God. Or C, creating a Nun of the Month Club.
Oh, my God. No pun intended.
Yeah, literally.
All right, you know what? I'm going to go out on a limb here. I'm going to go for the beauty pageant.
And you're right.
Oh,
well
wow.
done. The priest said that the nun beauty pageant was only intended to show their, quote, interior beauty, but the controversy caused it to be canceled anyway. All right, this is great. You have one more to go. If you get this right, you win. The sisters of the St. Francis of the Holy Eucharist Convent in Independence, Missouri, helped out their community in an unexpected way last year. What did they do? A, They raised money for a community center by selling a Ladies of St. Francis of the Holy Eucharist convent calendar.
Wow.
B, wearing habits and flip-flops, they chased down a robbery suspect leading to his arrest. Or C, they provided the hit Dunk-a-Nun booth at the Independence County Fair.
I'm going to have to go with the Dunk-a-Nun booth.
Dunk-a-Nun. There sits a nun. You throw a baseball at the target, the nun is dunked.
Yes.
I'm afraid it was they chased down the robber.
No.
Yes.
In flip-flops?
In flip-flops. The nuns looked out their window and saw a man hurrying by with a shotgun and boxing gloves. And they figured he was up to no good. And they chased him down and got a description and sent it to the police, and he was arrested for robbery. Carl, how did Tony Shalhoub do in our quiz?
Well, Tony needed at least two correct answers to win for Nancy Martin, but he had just one.
Oh, I'm sorry, Tony.
The Shapoopy will have to do.
Yeah.
Send her one.
I'm going to send her one.
Send her a Shapoopy.
Well, I'm very, very sorry that I, couldn't win this invaluable prize for your listeners.
Well, I think no one will ever remember it a moment from now.
Tony remember Shalhoub. What, Peter?
Exactly. There you go. Tony Shalhoub is an Emmy Award-winning star of TV's Monk, seen on the USA Channel. Tony Shalhoub, what a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thanks to all of you.
Bye-bye, Tony. Take care.
Next up, comedian, actor, and creator of the FX TV show, Rescue Me.
Dennis Leary joined us, along with Adam Felber, Mo Rocca, and Kerry O'Connor, back in December 2008, right after he wrote his self-help book, Why We Suck, a subject of some interest to us.
Yeah, it's a little trip through. It talks about why we're great and then all the things that we need, I think, a little touch-up on.
Really?
Like skinny jeans are for skinny people. I apparently, that's just lost on most of the population in this country.
Right.
Most of the people that are wearing them look like they jumped out of a 15-story window and landed in the jeans and then never took the jeans off. Meanwhile, the skinny people are wearing the hip-hop baggy jeans with the underwear showing. So all we got to do is really flip that. You know what I mean?
Are you worried that you've become one of those guys like kids these days? What's wrong with them?
Oh, I am that guy.
You're totally that guy.
Oh, yeah. You're totally that guy. I give that speech all the time.
Yeah.
I don't send my kids to their rooms. There's too much stuff in their rooms. There's plasma televisions, PlayStations. We go to their rooms when they do something wrong. You stay down here where the books are. We're going up there.
Speaking of kids, you actually write about yourself as a kid. You write about your background, which I find interesting. You grew up near Boston.
Yes. In Worcester, Massachusetts.
Worcester. Here's the thing. I mean, I imagine my experience is that most comedians, anyway, had childhoods. They were shy. They were a little lonely. They found out that being funny could maybe get them some friends. They went that way. That wasn't really your...
Really? You think most comedians are...
Yeah, that's been my experience.
I thought most of us, at some level, were repressed by religious figures in an organized religion.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, every guy I know, Chris Rock, John Stewart, John Stewart was in Hebrew school. I was in Catholic school. It was basically the same idea. Don't laugh at any of this. That's what they would tell you.
Right.
And it was the word... That's why I love organized religion, because they always want you to not laugh. And in the back of the room, we're all going,
really?
You know. If they had used reverse psychology, I wouldn't be here right now.
Dennis, do anything you want. It's cool. It's
fine. I'd be a priest.
One of the things I ended up really liking about your book were the characters of your parents. Not characters, but real people.
Real people.
I know. Really interesting. And I loved how they encouraged you to be all that you could be within limits.
Well, my parents were Irish immigrants that came from actually adjoining farms in Killarney. They came to New York and settled in Worcester, Massachusetts. And at that time, when I was a kid, President Kennedy was the President of the United States. And I went to school one day, and one of the nuns gave a speech about, if you're born in the United States, you can become the president. Anybody can be the president as long as you're born here. So I went home, and I said, Dad, Sister, you know, blah, 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 said that, you know, anybody that's born in the United States could be the president. And he said, that's true. And I said, does that mean that I could be the president? And he goes, hell no. What are you? Are you nuts? So it was a major blow to me at the time. And then I realized as I got older that he was trying to explain to me that you could be almost anything.
Almost anything.
But president was a little bit out of reach.
What?
So, you know, it was a self-esteem thing that was true, because I couldn't have been the president. First of all, I didn't pay attention in school at all. Which didn't help, you know, at all. No. I just chopped my own feet off in the presidential race.
Right.
So, because the
but you wouldn't want me as president. I can love these people who say, you know, I like Sarah Palin because she's so much like us. I don't want somebody like us running the country, okay? All right, I really don't. I think most of us suck, and I'm one of those people that sucks. I want somebody really smart running the country. All right?
Well, Dennis Leary, we're delighted to have you with us. We have invited you here this week to play a game we are calling...
Can you tell me how to get to Sesame Street?
The generation of men and women now running the world were shaped by more than anything the TV show Sesame Street. I'm sure you watched it as a kid.
Or no.
No, you're too old. That's
I'm
the thing.
Too old.
You're too old. That's why you're so bitter and mean, because you didn't have...
Look what happened.
So we're going to ask you three questions about that landmark kids show taken from the new authoritative history of Sesame Street called Street Gang by Michael Davis.
Okay.
You get two of these questions right, you win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl Castle, on their home answering machine, singing his theme song, It's Not Easy Being Avuncular. Carl, who is Dennis Leary playing for?
Dennis is playing for Edith Lees from Omaha, Nebraska.
All right. First question is, I'm sure you remember, or maybe you don't. Sesame Street was known for introducing kids to real-world concepts in a gentle way.
Mm-hmm.
One of the notable early examples was an episode in which one of these things happened. Was it A, Mr. Hooper's grocery store was vandalized? B, folk singer Buffy St. Marie breastfed her baby right in front of Big Bird? Or C, special guest star Elizabeth Taylor explained to Grover why she had had four different husbands?
Man, I'm going with A.
You're going to go with A?
Yeah.
It was Buffy St. Marie.
I can't believe
yeah.
it.
Really?
She really was. She was actually, she was a guest in the show for the first five seasons, and
really?
They went through her pregnancy and the birth of her baby, off screen, I hope, and so she breastfed him on camera, and Big Bird asked about it, and eventually said, quote, you know, that's nice, said Big Bird.
I can't believe Buffy St. Marie breastfed her.
It's true.
I can't believe Big Bird was okay with it.
Okay, here's your next question. The show, of course, was for kids, but produced, of course, by adults who, off-camera, acted like adults. At one of the season rap parties, the puppeteers introduced what new character just for their own entertainment? Was it A, Allie the alcoholic, B, Big Butt, or C, the Nookie Monster?
Oh.
I really got screwed on this quiz.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
So it's a rap party. You know what they're like. They're swinging around. They got a puppet.
Well, the rap party makes me think they'd go right to the Nookie Monster.
So, Nookie
I'm going with Nookie.
You're right. Nookie Monster.
Hey!
Not like that.
Well done, sir.
All right. All right. Last question. Many foreign television companies bought the rights to show the series in their own countries, but the head of children's programming for the BBC back in the late 60s turned it down. Why? Was it because, A, she thought the way the show insisted on right answers to questions was, quote, authoritarian indoctrination? Was it B, she noted that many of the Muppets were naked and therefore immodest? Or C, she felt that it was another attempt to create American cultural dominance of the English-speaking world?
I am going to go with the nudity.
You're going to go with the nudity. She's like, the Muppets were naked. She's like, this is... they don't...
Wait.
They don't know either.
You guys don't like the immodest idea?
No, they don't like it. They don't like it.
Okay. Let me float another one.
Just spitballing here.
What do you think of the authoritarian?
What would you
want C then? Is that what you want? All right, I'm going with you. We will sink or swim together. I'm going with C.
I applaud your solidarity, but you're all wrong.
It was A.
Authoritarian. She thought it was authoritarian the way they answered the questions correctly. You know this, Mom?
No, yes.
You know what? Yeah. Let's boo them until they give us the right answer that we want.
That's awfully authoritarian of you.
I know, it really is.
I'm sorry.
Really.
Sorry.
I know. At least we're together.
Right? Yeah.
We have a bond.
You would have been wrong without them.
Carl, how did Dennis Leary do in our quiz?
Well, Dennis needed two correct answers to win for Edith Lees, but he had just one.
Oh. Dennis Leary is a comedian and the star and co-creator of Rescue Me on the FX Network. He's also the author of the new book, Why We Suck. Dennis Leary, thank you so much for joining
us. Thanks, guys.
From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Carl Castle. And here again is your host at the Chase Bank Auditorium in downtown Chicago, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Carl. Thank you, everybody. You may know John Hodgman for his compendia of world knowledge, areas of my expertise, and more information than you require. You may know him as the Daily Show's resident expert, but you definitely know him as the PC in those great I'm a PC, I'm a Mac, Apple ads.
When he joined us along with Paul Prevenza, Amy Dickinson, and Paula Poundstone, he started by telling us about auditioning for those ads.
Well, they didn't really tell me much of anything.
Right.
But I gather they were looking for someone who was perhaps 37 years old, a little heavier than he used to be, a little wall-eyed. Technically, I'm not wall-eyed. I have a right hyper. My right eye is higher than my left eye. And I think that's what they were looking for.
Now, it is extraordinary to the extent to which you have become ubiquitous everywhere. You cannot not only turn on your TV, but your computer. You keep popping up on my computer in internet ads, which is disconcerting.
Yes. Well, I enjoy watching you while you work.
Thank you. But here is, I'm going to get to this. I turn on my TV. I don't see you. I see a guy that Microsoft has hired who looks like you, who they are putting up as a defense against the implied slander of your ads.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Come on. You must have seen this.
I don't watch television. You know me. It's certainly not ads. I loathe advertising.
I know. But there's a guy at Microsoft who got a job in an ad because he looks like you.
Yes, I've heard tell of such things.
I'm
very happy for him. You know, as somebody who has an accidental television career,
right.
I'm happy to see that happen to somebody else.
I see your
point. On purpose. That is so one world view.
How, and you talk about this a bit in your book, how has being a famous minor television personality, as you put it, affected your daily life, John?
Well, you may notice I'm wearing a tuxedo.
That is exciting.
Yes, very nice.
I always dress up for radio. I'm rather surprised to see that you people are not wearing tuxedos.
That's... You know why? These guys dress up to listen at home.
That's right.
That's how fancy they
are. They often come in pajamas, John. Count yourself lucky. But now, because you're a literary guy and author of books, and now you walk around the streets of New York City, and I presume people go nuts to see you.
Yes, I used to enjoy the anonymity of being a literary figure and occasionally a public radio figure.
Yes.
But now people come up to me and they point. Or they will often say, "You look like the guy in those ads."
And what do you say on that occasion?
There's a reason for that. The fact is, I'm very self-similar. I am fractal-like.
Yes, I see.
Thank you, nerds.
Let us talk about the areas of your expertise,
yes,
of which are immense. Because
that was my old book. That was the old technology.
I'm sorry, but now we moved on to...
The new technology, the upgrade, is entitled More Information Than You Require.
See, here's the thing. Your book, as you confess right up, it's all made up.
It is a book of trivia, much like the old Ripley's Believe It or Not or the Book of Lists, the advantage that all of the amazing true facts in my book are made up by me.
I wish you had told me that before.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Can't tell you how many bets I've lost.
Well, then I better not tell you how many I've won. You should really stop betting with me on subjects covered in my own book.
You actually have a section on bar bets, actually.
Yes, I do, absolutely. For example, do you know how you... It's called a proposition bet.
Yes.
You go into a bar and you find someone who's having a drink with their friends, and you interrupt them, and you say, "I bet I can make this match land on its end."
Right.
And then if they don't hit you, you have a chance to prove it.
Mm-hmm.
So here's the trick. This is what you do. You take the match, and you attach a little parachute to it and put some glue on the bottom of it. And you preset that in your jacket.
Right.
And you throw it up in the air, and I would say 2 times out of 10 it works.
I'll have to try that. I was also... intrigued and somewhat frightened by your explanation of the tradition of eating oysters.
Oh, yes. Oysters. Well, let me tell you. If you enjoy a food that tastes like snot... after it has been rubbed on rocks and old silverware...
Yes.
Then you may enjoy oysters. But do not listen. Do not listen to the killjoys who tell you never to eat oysters in months that do not contain the letter R, May, June, July... August, October, you know. They say that you should not eat oysters during those months because they are the warm months. They are the traditional spawning season of the oyster. And that, of course, is when the oyster tends to beg for its life while you're eating it, which some people find distracting or embarrassing for the oyster. But I say, if you're going to eat a creature alive, you have to expect some screaming. That is the, that is the carnivore's burden.
Don't you think? Well, John Hodgman, we are delighted to have you with us. We have asked you here to play a game that this time we're calling...
So you're a PC, huh? We'll see about that.
So you play a PC in
yes,
the commercials.
That is accurate.
But we've been watching them for a while, and we are beginning to suspect you're not really a PC at all. In fact, we think you're
I'm not a computer.
No,
that
no.
is correct.
We think, in fact, you're a cruel parody of the actual machine as created by its enemies. So we're going to ask you three questions about the history of the Microsoft Corporation. Get two of these questions right, you'll win our prize for one of our listeners. Carl's voice on their home answering machine.
Damned if you do, damned if you don't.
Exactly. Carl, who is John Hodgman playing for?
John is playing for Ron Blackmore of Madison, New York.
All right.
I'm very sorry, Ron. All right.
First question. In 1976, the young company launched its first print advertisement in a technical journal called Digital Design. What was this advertisement? Was it A, a picture of the young Bill Gates with his shaggy hair and aviator glasses and the slogan, "He's a stud"? B, a four-panel comic strip relating, quote, "The Legend of the Micro Kid"? Or C, a densely written description of its proprietary version of the basic computer language written specifically for the Altair personal computer?
I will say C, and here's the reason why.
Please.
Because, you know, I naturally own a lot of very old magazines. And I enjoy going to old magazines because the advertisements in those magazines tended to have thousands of words of copy in them.
They did.
Isn't that strange? For a video game, they would describe it in thousands of words. I mean, they were very wordy at the time. So that's why I'm going to say C.
I love your explanation, but in fact, the
answer was... No one loved my explanation. Don't lie to me.
I'm just trying to make you feel better. The answer was B. It was a four-panel comic strip.
Oh.
The Adventures of the Micro Kid. He was a boxer, you see. He had speed and power and needed a manager, say a kind of operating system, in order to succeed.
It sounds great.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I lost. Sorry about that.
No. You still have two more chances.
Oh, okay. Very well.
Once Microsoft got going in the early 80s, it needed a corporate symbol, and it found one. A logo known in the industry as what? A, the blibbit, B, the all-seeing eye, or C, the exploding head?
The blibbit.
The blibbit?
Yes.
You're right, sir. Oh. The blibbit. The blibbit looked like an O drawn with horizontal lines and lasted a few years. All right, this is very exciting.
This is the tiebreaker?
This is the tiebreaker. You get this right, yeah, you win.
I look forward to that.
Microsoft was challenged in its earliest days by another upstart company you might have heard of, Apple.
Microsoft, I hear they're very good.
Microsoft considered Apple, though, to be evil based on what very real evidence? A, if you typed a certain string of characters into the Apple I computer, it replied, "All hail Satan, all hail Satan."
They B, call that an Easter egg.
Yes.
B, ironic, isn't it?
B, the original price of the Apple I was $666.66. Or C, the original code name for the project that became the Macintosh, Lucifer.
The answer is B.
The answer is B. The original price was $666.66.
That is my final answer.
You are correct, sir. Very well done. Steve Jobs explained that he thought $666.66 would be an easy number to remember. I have to ask, you were so confident. Is that because as an Apple advertisement to yourself, you're up on the history of Apples, or did you just happen to know?
I don't wish to brag, but I'm very intelligent. And I did very luckily happen to know the answer to that question.
That's amazing. Carl, how did John Hodgman do in our quiz?
Well, John's intelligence was on display here, Peter. He had two correct answers, so he wins for Ron Blackmore.
Well done! A remarkable display of last-minute brilliance.
I'm just glad for Ron Blackmore.
as are we.
John Hodgman is a correspondent for The Daily Show. He's the PC on those I'm a Mac and a PC commercials. He is also the author of the excellent, hilariously funny new book, More Information Than You Require. John Hodgman, thank you so much for joining us.
Amos Sedaris and her brother, writer David Sedaris, used to work together under the name The Talent Family, and the name fits. She's a writer and actress, best known for her TV series, Strangers with Candy, and her book about entertaining called I Like You, Hospitality Under the Influence. When she joined us in December of 2006, along with Charlie Pierce, Mo Rocca, and Amy Dickinson, we started by asking her to explain the title.
Because when you invite someone into your home, be it a dealer or boyfriend, whatever, you're saying, I like you.
Right.
Right, yeah.
Well,
that's why.
I understand.
So and Under the Influence is really is about, you know, I was influenced by Girl Scouts and Junior Achievements and my second first grade teacher, you know, all the things that I've been, you know, influenced by. And then I have a whole chapter on how, what a pain in the butt it is to entertain people who do get drunk or really messed up on something, how they can single-handedly bring your party to a screaming halt. Because they always think of the life of the party, but really they bring it down.
Now, I noticed, I was leafing through the book, and I noticed it has many recipes.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
And
lots of pictures and large print.
Oh, yeah, lots of pictures and large print. I'm sure you did.
I really kept the illiterate in mind because a lot of people who can't read, that's one thing, and then there are a lot of people who just don't know how to read. So I wanted to do a visual book so that when they saw the picture, it would inspire them to write their own story in their head.
Right. Do you advise? I mean, are these real recipes if I make these recipes?
I took it seriously. A lot of the humor came from Paul Dinello making fun of the fact that I was trying to be serious. So I decided to make it a little bit more entertaining than I originally wanted to because I just don't like joke cookbooks. And it would just go into a wacky pile and nobody would take it seriously. So it's all real.
Including, like, your list of munchies?
Munchies! Yeah, that was a hard list to come up with.
Yeah, I could tell. Cause
someone thought I was holding a hummingbird feeder in that picture, and it's a bong, and it's so funny to me. I'm like, why would I be holding a hummingbird feeder looking like that? That's so funny to me.
I mean, the list starts
that
out okay.
That could explain why the hummingbirds fly upside down and backwards in my yard.
Yeah.
I thought it was a hummingbird feeder when I found it in the garage.
No, they got some good chronic. That's what it is.
Forgotten I own that.
Well, Amy Sedaris, we are delighted to have you with us. We have asked you here to play a game we're calling...
Drinking This Much will either win me a Pulitzer Prize or make not winning a lot easier to take.
Not all great writers are drinkers, but certainly it often seems that way. We recently came across a book called Hemingway and Bailey's Bartending Guide.
Wow.
It's a book of anecdotes and cocktail recipes from the country's famous authors. We'll ask you three questions about the drinking habits of literary geniuses in history.
Okay.
Get two questions right, you will win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl's voice on their home answering machine.
Wow, okay.
Okay, so Carl, who is Amy Sedaris playing for?
Amy is playing for David Tuttle of Arcata, California.
Okay.
All right, ready?
Yes.
Here we go. Here's your first question. There are big drinkers, and then there's Jack Kerouac. The author of On the Road once got so drunk he did what? A, he roasted, cut up, and ate a Goodyear truck tire. B, he enlisted in the Navy, Coast Guard, and Marines on the same day. Or C, he got married to a 47-year-old elevator operator who spoke no English.
Oh, they're all so good. Sophie's choice. I'm going to say three.
You're going to say he got married to that 47-year-old elevator operator who spoke no English.
It's not true. I'm going to say three, but I bet it's two.
Ooh. Well, what are you going to say? I want you to.
I am saying three, but I bet it's two.
I don't know what this says about you. It is the second choice. It's B.
Yeah,
yes.
It is. Yeah.
It was the Navy, Coast Guard, and Marines.
I knew it.
So why didn't you?
That's what I would do. I would get on a line. You know, when you're like that, and you just call everybody. But I don't know. I like the idea of three, but I knew it was two.
All right. Yeah, he did. He enlisted on the same day into the Navy, Coast Guard, and Marines. Strangely, by the time he sobered up, he was on board a ship headed for Greenland. He was in the Merchant Marine. Mm.
So I know I lost it, but
No, you have two more chances if you get the next two right.
It was a choice to lose.
If you get two more right, you will win. So don't lose hope. Here we go. Author Sherwood Anderson died from drinking, not in the way, though, you might
think. That's hilarious. Go on.
But he did not die in the way you might think. What finally did him in? Was it A, he realized his newly bought bottle of scotch was Johnny Walker Red, not black. He turned around to go return it and was hit by a truck. B, he was talking and drinking and eating at a shipboard cocktail party and he swallowed a toothpick. Or C, he suggested to a sailor that drinking creme de menthe was, quote, sort of a namby-pamby thing to do, is it not, unquote.
It was two.
The toothpick?
Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah.
That's what happened.
I was going to say toothpick of our campaign, but...
Wow.
Yeah.
Toothpick is very dangerous. I know that.
Yeah, and he
that
died.
That campaign button.
Have you swallowed a campaign button?
No, not yet.
Okay, you've gotten one right. You've gotten one right. Well, anyway, that is how Sherwood Anderson died. He swallowed a toothpick, it gave him peritonitis, and he passed away. It's true. If you get this last question correct, Amy, you will, in fact, win. Here we go.
Wow, I never win anything.
Well, you might win this. Last question. Thomas Wolfe, the author, of course, of You Can't Go Home Again, Look Homeward, Angel. He could be alarming as a drinking buddy. Why? A, he liked to bite off parts of his glass and chew on them. B, when he ran out of liquor in the middle of the night, he would break into friends' homes and drink theirs. Or C, he liked to challenge people to a drinking game called I Can Down Any Bottle of Any Booze in 60 Seconds.
He sounds like a terrible guest.
Is he saying anybody? I know he's dead. Let's see. Gosh, okay, chewing the glass, which, okay, that's a possibility. I'm going to say three.
You're going to go with C, that choice.
It's not C. I can tell by you're disappointed in my choice.
No, I was just trying to build up some dramatic tension. I wasn't trying to indicate
one. Well, you're doing a good job. Now I'm depressed.
But that is your choice, C.
Yeah, but I bet it's one. What is it?
Yes, it was one, I'm afraid. Yes.
You know why I thought it was one? Because my brother David had this Ronco glass cutter, and he would take our wine bottles and make them into glasses, but he would never sand the edges, so when we would drink from the glass, we would all cut our lips. Oh. And that's why I thought it was believable. But damn it, I picked C.
Yeah, you did. Jeez. And he did like, Thomas Wolfe apparently did like to chew glass. We don't know why.
Wow.
But he did.
Well, I guess I'm a loser.
Well, let's find out. Carl, how did Amy Sedaris do in our quiz?
Well, she said it. To make it official, Amy needed two correct answers at least to win. She had just one correct answer.
I know. We all know. Why repeat it? Now I'm depressed.
No. Amy Sedaris is a comedian, actress, and author of the new book, I Like You, Hospitality Under the Influence. Amy Sedaris, thank you so much
for joining us. Thank you so much, you guys.
That's it for our holiday show. We hope you enjoyed it as much as we've enjoyed the time off we got by not actually putting together a new show. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kauffman Foundation, working to grow economies and expand human welfare. Learn more at Kauffman.org. The Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. And the AMARC Foundation, supporting ProCon.org, a website for teachers and the public to explore the pros and cons of controversial issues. Wait, Don't Tell Me is a production of NPR and WBEZ Chicago in association with Urgent Haircut Productions. Doug Berman, executive producer. Philip Goedeke writes our limericks, our house manager, Don Hall. Our intern is Blythe Haga, our web guru, Beth Novi. Engineers include Les Dolarchik and Muhammad Mao. Thanks to John Zajac at Chase Bank, BJ Lederman composed our theme. Our program is produced by Ian Chillog, Eva Waltrover, and Emily Ecton. Technical direction is from Robert Newhouse and Lorna White. The senior producer of Wait, Don't Tell Me is Mike Danforth. Thanks to Carl Castle. Thanks to all of our panelists. Thanks to you for listening. I'm Peter Sagal. We'll see you next week. This is NPR.